welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and professional speaker, bringing you interviews, inspiration and information on writing, publishing options and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free Author 2.0 blueprint and lots more information at thecreativepen.com, and that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hi everyone, I'm Joanna Penn and it is the 12th of May 2014 and this is episode 183 of the podcast. Now today I have a great interview with Jane Friedman, who is an academic. She's been in publishing for years and years. She speaks everywhere. She writes everywhere. She's brilliant. And we are talking about the intersection of money, writing and life. And we go into why business and art seem to be such sensitive topics when mentioned together. Business models for authors and some of the factors that link authors earning over $100,000 a year. So hopefully that will be interesting for you. It certainly was for me. But before we go into the interview, a few things for my introduction. So industry news, I think what's been the weirdest thing the last couple of weeks? Well, just Amazon continually innovating. It's the hash Amazon cart hashtag on Twitter, which will add a book to someone's basket if their Twitter account is linked. Now, I buy a lot of books based on Twitter recommendations, so it really interests me. And I have tried it, but the book didn't end up in my basket. So quite interesting, because I think it was an Amazon.com thing and I mainly use .co.uk and blah, blah, blah. So it's an interesting thing, but regardless, it has brought a lot of conversation about whether people buy books on Twitter. So I certainly do. I think whichever social network you are dominant on becomes a way to get book recommendations. So that certainly is interesting for me. I also wanted to mention a new podcast that I'm finding really interesting is the Sell More Books show with Jim Cookroll from Author Marketing Club and Brian Cohen, and that's at sellmorebooksshow.com or on iTunes, Stitcher, I think, and the rest. And they round up book marketing news, and there's very little waffle and chat, which is great. So it is around half an hour, 40 minutes, so about half the length of the brilliant self-publishing podcast and also the rocking self-publishing podcast, both of which I recommend as well, but they are longer, so depending and not so targeted. So Jim and Brian's show is specifically around sell more books. So yeah, anyway, I'm finding that interesting. And also talking about Author Marketing Club, of which Jim runs, check your Amazon descriptions, as it looks like they've stopped using Author Central as the place that updates your book description and have gone back to what's on KDP. Now you can format your KDP with nice HTML as part of the premium service at Author Marketing Club, and I have put a link in the show notes so you can have a look at that if you're interested. Another thing that seems to be happening is more authors I know are moving to use Ingram Spark for print in combination with CreateSpace. So you use CreateSpace for Amazon only, and then you use Ingram Spark for the extended distribution into libraries, bookstores, etc. This seems to be better because bookstores happily order from the catalogues, but not so much from CreateSpace. There is a interview with Ingram Spark people on the Alliance of Independent Authors YouTube channel, which I will again link to in the show notes. Really interesting. I think if you do have print as a business model, as part of your business model, then it is worth doing. I'm just not a print type of girl anymore, so I haven't really focused on sorting out my print distribution so much. So I still just use CreateSpace, but we shall see. You never know. I am always happy to have my mind changed, and at the moment some of my Uber author friends are doing that. So yeah, check out Ingram Spark if you are taking print seriously. My news? I have quite a lot of news. I've actually been, again, quite overwhelmed recently. Day of the Vikings is out as an ebook on all ebook stores, and it was super fun to write. I went to the British Museum Viking exhibition on the first day it opened back in March, and the book came out basically March, April, May, 2 months later. So it's only 22,000 words, so it's a novella. And it was a real cathartic action adventure thriller, basically. And part of the reason for writing it was that I had finished the first draft of Delirium, which is, again, another very dark mystery set in London, this time around the history of psychiatry, set in the modern day, but with a lot of some nasty psychiatric stuff involved. So I needed some light relief. And I read Jeremy Robinson writes an awesome series of Jack Sigler adventures, and I read his little novella Guardian, which was fun, and I don't often use the word fun about my writing. Sounds terrible, because my husband says I'm a serious little sausage, and I am, really. I'm a serious person. You probably got that, the drift of that. So for me to write something that's fun is quite unusual. Now, I generally have a lot of fun with my arcane books in that I like to blow stuff up and things, but actually Vikings was fun to write. And I think it's the first time it's happened. I also feel I nailed the structure, like I really nailed it, and it didn't need much editing, so I was really happy with that. Anyway, opens at the British Museum as a group of neo-Vikings come to reclaim an ancient staff of power, and murder and mayhem ensue, and I may or may not be blowing up the roof of the British Museum. You can check out the book if you want to read more. And it features Morgan Sierra from Arcane and Blake Daniel from Desecration, now the first in the London Mysteries, as I'm making that into a series. On that series, Desecration is out in audiobook format on Audible, Amazon and iTunes, and has an English narrator, which is fantastic. She's amazing, Rosalind. Delirium has now gone through three drafts. It's now with my editor and beta readers, and then we'll go through another edit. So I fully expect it to come out in July at this point. And I'm getting together ideas for the next one, which will be called Deviance. Now, those of you who have been following me a while, back when I wrote Pentecost and then Prophecy, I was heading down the P route for the Arcane series, and then I changed my mind and started on Exodus. So it may be that the London Mysteries all start with DE. I have a lot of good words up my sleeve. But I don't know, I just like book titles with one strong word. So, and then I'm going to have these series of novellas, which will be Day of, or, you know, so I've got Day of the Vikings and One Day in Budapest. And I up my sleeve have potentially One Day in New York, because I'll be heading to New York in July for Thriller Fest. So always good to blow stuff up around New York. Obviously, I won't be talking about that in public in America. But yeah, anyway, so that's kind of what I'm doing in English. Excitingly, also, Pentecost will be out in German on the 23rd of May, so I'm self-publishing that and using epubli.de to distribute to the German kind of country-specific sites. They have a lot more contacts, and Germany does have some other, the Tolino and e-readers that we don't have, so that's interesting. I've also had a pre-read up at Vorablesen. My accent is terrible, but I'm going to put that in the show notes as well, because that's a great site for using to get reviews early and just test the market. And we're doing incredibly well with reviews, so I'm really thrilled and feeling less concerned that the books will do well in Germany. I've also signed a contract for digital imprint, a new imprint from Ullstein, which is a big German publisher, called Midnight. So their imprint is called Midnight, and Desecration will come out with them in July. So two books in German this year, quite excited about that. And I will eventually be able to reveal my translators, although obviously I'm protecting them because I want them to do all my work. Desecration in Italian is also in final reads, so we're going to see what happens with that. And Pentecost in Italian and Spanish still in process. Other things happening, I'm off to Bristol Crime Fest this week. I'm doing an hour on self-publishing and then also doing a panel on Sunday called Emerging Indie Voices, which I'm really pleased about because it's the first year that Bristol Crime Fest has allowed self-published authors to, you know, to kind of do this, you know, actually have a panel. So that's very important that we do well with that. Very important that we act professionally and encourage literary festivals and prizes to book indies. And to that end, I want to recommend the latest book from the Alliance of Independent Authors, which is called Opening Up to Indie Authors, a guide for bookstores, libraries, reviewers, literary event organisers and self-publishing writers. And it's full of great tips on how to get your book into bookstores and libraries, etc., as well as how we should behave and guidelines for those type of groups as well. So it's an excellent book. I really recommend you get it. There's also a petition that you can sign around getting these kind of groups to open up. Again, I do feel like we're in this, the next 5 years, we will still be fighting these battles. And then I really truly believe that it will just be books and people won't, it won't even be a discussion anymore. It will just be, everyone will be mixed up and we'll have these kind of business models. A bit about it, I think about it in, because I live in London. I think about it in the way that people say, I'm a Londoner, and they could be, you know, white British whose family have been here for generations. They could be, you know, arrived in the 60s from, or, you know, wherever around the world. And we have a big Indian and Pakistani populations. We have a big black British population. We have a lot of Eastern Europeans now. You know, my friends are from all over the world, and they all call themselves Londoners. And I almost see this multiculturalism in the book world in the next few years. I really hope that it becomes that. It's like no longer it's us and them. It's like we're all mixed together. We're all authors, whether we're going through traditional or small publishing house or indie or whatever. So there's my little multicultural story. I think I just want everyone to love each other and hold hands and be happy writers and just get on with it. Just get on and write some books, basically. Okay, on that note, talking about books, Kobo helps us publish our books and does so very well. And the podcast is sponsored by Kobo Writing Life. So here's a short message from our sponsor.
Hey, Creative Pen listeners, this is Christine Monroe. I'm the US manager for Kobo Writing Life. I'm really excited to be ramping up our partnership with the American Booksellers Association. I'm starting with organizing events at local bookstores and bringing in local independent authors. So please head on over to KoboWritingLife.com where you can find out all the latest news on this project. And I hope you can join me at an event at a local bookstore near you. Thanks for listening. I'll hand it back over to your host, Joanna.
Hi everyone, I'm Joanna Penn from thecreativepen.com and today I'm here with Jane Friedman. Hi Jane!
Hello Joanna!
It's great to have you back on the show. Now just as an introduction, Jane has spent more than 15 years in the media industry as an editor, publisher and professor. She's currently the web editor of the Virginia Quarterly Review based at the University of Virginia, where she also teaches digital publishing and online writing. She's also the editor of Scratch Magazine, which focuses on writing and money and life, which we are focusing on today. Jane, you're everywhere at the moment, and I was saying, does that about cover your background?
Yeah, that's a great, great high-level summary.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, you're sort of a big figure, I think, in the publishing community these days. So I'm really thrilled to have you on the show. So I wanted to sort of start off
I actually get quite a lot of personal criticism for my own focus on the business of being an author. You know, some people think if you talk about business, then you must not care so much about the craft or the language. And people think art and business can't go together. So why do you think there's such an issue with money and art? And why did you start Scratch because of this?
Yeah. I would say it's interesting. We're starting with this question because I just spoke on it at a conference over the weekend about the historical perspectives on money and art and business and writing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I did a really deep dive into some of our cultural attitudes towards art and business. And our thinking on this issue goes back a few hundred years. So it's kind of like there's this like ingrained idea in the culture that the two things are antithetical to each other. And that idea was invented. It was invented by someone who was frustrated with his sales and felt like the only way to rescue his art was to say that it was superior because that it didn't sell. and we've had that idea ever since, this myth of the starving artist, that to, you know, keep our art pristine and to preserve this value to it, that we can't pay attention to the marketplace. And I recently read a book by Elizabeth Hyde Stevens. She did this book called Make Art, Make Money, which focuses on some of the lessons we can learn coming out of Jim Henson's life, the great artist and puppeteer, and how he, you know, balanced these two sides and didn't see them as opposed, that he saw how to make business serve art and how, you know, he could use it as a way to fulfill his artistic vision. Mm-hmm. It's not that he was pandering or selling out, but he knew how to use the system to his own purposes. Mm. And so I think it's horrible that any writer or artist should be criticized for operating in the realities of the marketplace. Mm-hmm. I mean, certainly there are people who do totally pander, and, you know, everyone has to make certain sacrifices to go to the next level. But it totally ignoring the interrelation of these two things and how art has often thrived because of the support of business and patrons or sales. I mean, this has been a relationship that goes back for a very long time, and it doesn't, art can't operate in a vacuum. I'm not sure why we ever thought it could, or that it should, or that it was somehow superior for it to do so. I think the tension that results is actually quite healthy. You know, we need a little bit of that fence, a little bit of that challenge to you know, push us to do better, to go further, to think creatively. So I see it. I don't. You know, I'm. It strikes me that sometimes when I talk about these issues, I don't want to sound like strident. Like, I don't take it really, really seriously. Like, I'm sincere about advocating that writers think about the art and the business as something that can successfully play together. But I'm not like saying you're wrong if you can't be a business person. It's more about being open to the possibility that these things can work together.
Mm. Well, for me, I feel very passionate. I have a lot of young women in my life, my nieces and my, you know, and my goddaughter, and they're at the stage where they're being told, you know, you have to do the certain courses so you can get a proper job. And I feel like one of my driving forces is I want to prove that being an artist, being a creative and a writer is a, in quotes, proper job. That parents can feel happy that their children go into. But in order to do that, you have to be able to pay your bills, right?
Yes. Yes, you do. And, you know, a lot of people want to know at what point can I, like, just focus on the writing or not have to worry about the day job or kind of let go of some of the realities of life. And that's a very hard question to answer because I think it's so personality driven and what kind of sacrifices you're able to make, some of your personal circumstances, if you have family members to support and take care of. There are so many factors that play into the decision and what kind of stamina you have and your acceptance of risk. Mm. I think it's definitely possible to be an artist and an entrepreneur and to not have the so-called day job, but there's also quite a bit of work and persistence that goes into reaching the level where you where you feel a little bit, let's say, I don't want to say comfortable exactly, but you don't feel like anxious all the time about where the next paycheck's going to come from. So risk tolerance is really important, as well as just having some patience for what work you are putting into the whole process to pay off. I think sometimes this is the difficulty that every writer faces, is they want results now, or financially they need to have the results now. And I've found over and over again, it's not something you can necessarily force. It's not at your command. And there's quite a bit of faith that goes into it. In fact, the last issue of Scratch, my magazine on writing and money, that the theme is faith. The faith that the work that you put in is actually going to pay off in the long run, financially or otherwise.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And one of the things I did when I was going to give up my job, which I did nearly 3 years ago now, is we sold everything. We completely downsized our life. We sold our house so we don't have any debt. We don't have a car. You know, we completely downsized. And that really took the pressure off.
Yeah,
which
exactly.
Meant that I could earn less money, and I do earn significantly less money now.
Yeah,
but I'm so much happier.
Right, exactly. So there are trade-offs that you've made, the so-called sacrifices, and everyone has to look at their own lifestyle requirements and see what's really possible.
Yeah, and it was really interesting. Again, in Scratch, you interviewed your editor partner interviewed Cheryl Strayed, who wrote Wild, brilliant book, obviously. I've got a quote here. Writing is a terrible way to make a living when it comes to the statistical chances that you will make a living. But if you can make a living at it, there's a sort of poetry to how it works. So I wondered, you know, and she talks about her credit card debt and how a multi six figure advance can disappear, right. You know, with all the, and it's a brilliant article. But I wondered if you could maybe talk about what are some of the business models that authors can have in this new world, I guess.
Well, I mean, the traditional old fashioned model is strictly book sales. And everyone thinks that there was probably some golden era where authors made a living off of sales. If you look back, that's not necessarily true. Even authors like Mark Twain or Charles Dickens, who were quite successful by the standards of the day, often made more money on things like lectures and readings and appearances and serials and things of that nature. I mean, part of this depends on the genre or the community that you're in, like if you're a genre writer versus a literary writer. But I think, especially on the literary side, the prevailing model is teaching and doing things related to educating other writers, which has, in fact, become a little more difficult because of the glut of MFA students being produced. That's a whole other problem that we could talk about. And then on the genre side, there's still that education component, being a teacher. But what I'm seeing that's really interesting is probably on the nonfiction and journalism side, we're seeing subscription and membership models. Whether it's a blogger or someone who's running a full-fledged site or community, having some kind of wall where you're paying for access. Or it's kind of like this positive paywall, where you get a lot of the experience for free, but if you're a really devoted, like, Uber fan, then you're going to have to pay some kind of fee to, like, get community board access or get special privileges or be able to email the person behind the scenes who's running the site. So those are some other interesting ways, more probably applicable to nonfiction. But certainly, I think something that you've participated in lately is very interesting, the collective, the Deadly Dozen release. And I think there's some really interesting opportunities that haven't fully been explored in how authors can form collectives and do work together to bring a greater audience to everybody. I'm really interested in seeing where that goes and what other models.
Well, I think what I was thinking in that the collaboration model is almost the only way to become more scalable. So I'm doing 50-50 royalty share with translators who are also going to be marketing partners. So I don't have to do any more, you know, writing work. I can help them with marketing and we both make 50%, which takes one book and exploits the rights. So I see that as, like you're saying, a collaboration kind of model.
Right, exactly. So trying to look at a big picture level, big picture level. There's like the collaboration, there's the readers that pay you, there's the crowdfunding where readers and other kind of passersby, patrons, and that patron might be a wealthy person who really believes in what you're doing, or nonprofits or government agencies. I know, especially in Canada, I don't know if the same is true in the UK, but in Canada, I know there's a very, there's more of an environment there where as a writer or artist, you can expect more assistance than you can in the United States. So there are lots of different ways to go about it. And I think probably at the moment, it's best to diversify. Like, I would never recommend someone focus on one to the exclusion of all others. You kind of have to usually put together a collection of these things, especially earlier in your career. I think the longer you stick with it, the more freedom you have to say, to shut some doors and say, I'm only going to focus on this.
Mm. And I tell you what, I think there's some problems that need to be solved. And you have these big question blog posts that you smart set. That's what you've called, yeah. Which are great. And one of my big questions that I want to see happening is, you know, like ACX will do the royalty distribution. That's what's missing in these collaborative deals. So with the Deadly Dozen, we needed to have somebody else to collect the money and distribute the money. With ACX does that with my translators. I've realized I have to do that, and I'm not happy about it. I actually want to pay an agent or some middleman to do that kind of distribution of royalty for less money than a publisher, basically. And I see that as that piece in the puzzle is the thing that's missing to allow more authors to do this. I mean, I would be doing more of this if there was an easier way to split the money, basically.
Right, right. Yeah, I totally hear you, which is why I have a lot of interest in the collective idea, because because providing the administrative, the administration behind what you're talking about for a more reasonable fee than a publisher, for sure, and maybe even an agent. Although I wonder if agents aren't going to be more helpful in that as time goes on. I guess we'll see.
Mm. But yeah, I see that as like a role, like the companies starting in that niche, I think could do potentially very well, just to, you know, clip the ticket on the way through and manage all of that. You know, that could really change things.
Yeah.
And as you said, I think that's starting to happen. Now, one of the things, I guess, as well is that you're aware of many of the people in this space who are doing very well. I wonder, what do you see as the commonalities between authors who are making, let's say, over 100,000 US a year? Mm. Like, what are those people doing?
At the moment, this is very trend-driven, I want to point out. Mm. They tend to be quite prolific. They're producing a lot of work, and I don't mean necessarily books. It could also be, it could be a combination of books and blog posts and classes and social media activity. And like, it's the omnipresent feeling, like they're everywhere at once. You wonder how they can produce so much work. So there's that. I think they're also very consistent in what they're producing. They're very focused on serving a particular readership or community. And they've usually been in it for quite a while, because it to reach six figures, that's an engine that's taken a long time to build. So unless you're like one of these, overnight successes, which I actually don't believe in, you've probably had a run up of a decade or more to that type of income. And I think that also that income entails usually a lot of insight into who you're reaching and how, like on a numbers level, like through analytics and an in-depth insight into who's buying your stuff and how to get them to buy the next thing, whatever that is.
Mm. No, it's great you say that. I agree. I think, you know, I met Barbara Freethy at the London Book Fair, and I think she really struck me because she's just such a kind of nice, quiet, normal lady, you know, or a good businesswoman. But the fact is, she has 38 books and she's been writing for 20 years. So, you know, and then if you actually do the maths, 38 books, you only have to sell, you know, 500 or so a month of each of those books, and you do make a lot of
money. Exactly.
So and it's so funny because the penny dropped for me. It was like, oh, this is how publishers are so rich. This is why publishing has been a great business. It's like, ding! Because I don't think you get that perspective when you only have a couple of books, right? You can't
That's
see
true.
It. You can't see. And then that once you understand how publishing does make so much money, you know, you can see how you could do it too.
Right, yes. To become almost like a small press. Yeah.
Yes, basically. It's so interesting. But I wondered, you know, so if people listen, some people listening will be going, oh, wow, that sounds so exciting. And other people going, oh, my goodness, that's just way, way, way too much for me. You know, how do people, if people want to go this route, you know, how do people transition from being an author, say with one or two books, to running a business as mm-hmm. an author?
Mm-hmm. Sometimes I think you recognize the change once it's time to switch gears. And by that I mean that you suddenly realize that you're turning a profit, which for most writers that doesn't happen for quite some time, where you're actually, your expenses are below what your income is for the writing itself. Mm. When you realize that you have to start saying no, I think that's a major turning point for a lot of people, because especially early in your career, you want more opportunities, and you're also probably trained to say yes, accept everything, get all the exposure you can, write for free, etc. And then you realize, oh, I can't do that anymore, because the number of quality opportunities or the amount of money you can make doing your own thing outweighs the lesser requests or opportunities. So I think that's also a critical juncture. Realizing when you might actually have enough money to hire assistants, even if that's just like a virtual assistant, because you realize that 1 or 2 hours of time, you have more earning potential in that time than, say, tackling your email inbox. So I think those are signs that you need to start thinking a little more strategically, and you also need to like set up quarterly income and expense spreadsheets, and start tracking the growth and being very strategic about, okay, in the last 6 months, I got more money from X than Y. Mm-hmm. Why is that? And how am I going to change what I'm going to do in the next 6 months as a result? I think that sort of strategic thinking is overwhelming and probably too much for the person who at the moment may only have 1 or 2 books. Like that's like, how will I ever reach that? So I think it's kind of like you have to take it like Anne Lamott says, bird by bird,
yeah.
Book by book, step by step. You don't want to try and like master that right out of the gate. I think there's an overwhelming momentum that you reach and you realize, okay, it's time. I need to be smarter with how I'm prioritizing my work.
Mm. Yeah, I'm going through all of that sort of right now. I really feel, you know, at that point, and I'm gonna write another book about it, I think, because, you know, I think like many writers like yourself as well, you actually work things out when you write about it.
Totally.
So I'm almost like, I don't know what I think until I've written it.
Yes.
Which is kind of crazy. Now, you mentioned like, you know, profit spreadsheets there, and I did want to you know, because I did say this to someone the other day. I said, well, what's your profit? Not, you know, I said, what's your P&L on that book? And she went, what are you talking about? So you actually have a P&L in Scratch. You go through one. I wondered if you would explain a kind of overview of what that is, from obviously that was from a traditional perspective, but also yes. how people can assess that themselves.
Yeah, so in Scratch we ran this profit and loss statement that a traditional publisher would use, but an independent author could totally use it. And what it does is it calculates upfront, okay, what are all of my expenses going to be, like on a freelance basis, and then on like a unit cost if you're doing print books or if you have ISBN costs, those sorts of things. You build in all of the costs upfront, estimated and actual. Mm-hmm. And you can even put your hourly rate in there if you want to, like, you know, like pay yourself an hourly rate. And then you have to do some sales estimates, and hopefully you can do that based on a historical perspective of what the last book did, or talking with other people, what their experience has been, if they're willing to be transparent about it. And so then you plug in the sales numbers, and you also calculate, you know, the discount that the retailer is getting. And then you see, okay, how much money am I going to make in, say, the first year of sales? And then you can also run it for longer. You can run it for 2 years or 5 years or 10 years to get an idea of what's the potential for this book. And then what's really interesting, I think, is if you, in publishing, we would call it a season P&L, where you would take all of the books that you were going to publish in a specific season. That might be 10 books or 100. And then you look at the bigger picture, because then you put all of your low profit books with your high profit books and you see if you're hitting the right target. So an author could do that with all of the books they have planned to release in like a 3 to 5 year period. Kind of the more, the projects maybe, you know, won't sell as well against the projects that are a little more catering to your readers or to your market that you know will, and then see what the overall picture is.
Yeah, that's a really good idea. And I especially like the 3 to 5 year idea or the 10 year idea, because of course people, like you say, people want money right now. And the fact is, the great thing about self-publishing is you get to make a little bit of money hopefully every month for a long time, rather than getting a bigger spike and then potentially never seeing anything else. I mean, do you think that one of the biggest issues is the short-term thinking in across all publishers?
Totally, 100% agree. Short-term thinking is one of the greatest banes of any company, publisher, author's existence. Everyone is so focused on, can I get this to pay off in 2 weeks or 2 months or even 2 years? Mm. And I try to emphasize in all of my talks and blog posts, like, it took a long time, even for me. Like, and I feel like, you know, I kind of do things all right. Like, it takes me a while to get the hang of it, but it, you know, it takes 2 years, 3 years, 4 years before things gain steam, and I really feel a little more comfortable or have some mastery where I can actually say, all right, what are the results? Mm-hmm. People seem to have a lack of patience and stamina to some degree, and they're not willing to let things play out. And that's why I also emphasize sustainability in whatever you're doing. Like, you don't want to burn out in the first year, going down a checklist of social media activities or whatever it happens to be because someone told you to, without any recognition of what it is you can actually enjoy or do regularly, that so that it does, you know, amount to something after 3 or 5 years of doing it, and that you can feel like you can point back and say, that was meaningful work, that was a good journey, and I learned something, regardless of the results. So,
Yeah, and I really feel that too. I feel in the last year I've relaxed a lot more around, like, launch. Like, I put out a book this week, and I'm kind of not even, you know, making a fuss about it. I've sent an email to my list. I only just started tweeting, like, just before we started speaking, and like, I'm just not that bothered anymore about the initial bit. It's just another thing in, you know, in the body of work as such.
Exactly. So yeah, you're in it for the long game. I'm in it for the long game. So I don't have to be so, like, anxious about, did I achieve the sales goal in the first year? Because I'm going to keep doing it. And I know that time is on my side.
Yeah. And I wondered about that. Do you think it's partly the fault of big publishers who have kind of sold a dream, and there's been this kind of veil of secrecy over the reality of sales? Do you think that dream has now disintegrated?
I wish it would disintegrate a little more. I like to call it the myth, and I don't use that as like a judgmental word, but like as the Joseph Campbell myth, like the myth of the published author who produces this book, and that's when your writing life becomes sustainable, when you get that contract from a publisher and it releases. By far, the most disappointed authors I meet are the ones who've just had their first book release, and they're like, that's it? There's nothing, like, uh-oh. And they don't, I mean, certainly a first book is cause for celebration, and you, like, at every step of the way, you should be celebrating these milestones, but, like, that's just the beginning. That's, like, the very first step into a much larger career. So, and I think publishers, in whatever ways they've been reticent or secretive or just kind of, I don't know, ignorant of not like sharing the realities. I don't think they've helped themselves, because it also creates this antagonism, like, of disappointed authors or the authors with the incorrect expectations. So of course their fury or their disappointment is going to be directed at their publisher in many cases. So I don't think it benefits the publishers to be anything except upfront about what's going to happen. And maybe some are, and the authors just don't hear it. You know, they have on the rose colored glasses and they don't actually hear the conversation in honest terms, because they think, well, I'm the exception. Like, yeah, all authors think that. My book will be different. I'll get on the bestseller list. I will make a living. So I guess there's plenty of blame to go around for the myth.
Yeah, and it's funny, because I had a drink with an editor from a publishing house, and she actually said, and I asked her, like, I was showing her pictures of the portal, you know, the KDP, you know, I can see my sales. And she said, well, we can't do that with our authors, because they don't want to see the reality of their daily sales. The fact is, most books do sell very few copies a day, right? You know,
very few. Having worked at a mid-sized publisher, I saw the sales reports and I knew exactly what the expectations were, but there was totally this cultural reticence, and also like rules that you shouldn't share specific sales numbers because of the trouble that could cause. I always found it just very unproductive all around. I felt like if you could have a very transparent, authentic conversation with the author within the environment of a relationship that you've already established, like between the editor and the author, or the agent, editor, and author, and talking about the full context of how we've come to this point, why the sales are this way, I think that's very, very good. But most publishers just, they don't take the time, or they've been burned one too many times, so.
Yeah, and I want people to feel good about that. The reason why I bring it up is because it's the reality. Most books sell very few copies every day, whether you're indie published or traditionally published.
Yes.
But hopefully that continues for a long time. You know, that's kind of that is the business model, is small over time.
Right. And I hope that publishing, the traditional publishing, I hope it gets away from this launch mentality. I think slowly we're getting away from that. I mean, I think the independent authors have been so good at pointing out to the larger community that, you know, let's not focus on the first 3 months or 6 months, because the real potential is over the career. But publishers, you know, have traditionally been so terrible at backlist marketing and just going on to the next season.
Then
they're not capitalizing on kind of the riches of the backlist. There are some exceptions to that, but I think they also have to change gears. And because in the digital era, you know, every book can be new, regardless of how old it is at the moment it's discovered.
Absolutely. And I guess, you know, we mentioned a little bit about rights before. What are some of the things that you're seeing now? I mean, a lot of people are now doing Germany. It does seem to be, you know, the next thing. I've got my first book in German coming out in a couple of weeks, and I hear a lot of indies now talking about that. And obviously audio is just starting. It's just hit the UK with ACX. What are some of the rights that you see, the rights exploitation, the other opportunities for indies that are coming up now?
You've hit on two of the biggest. So the audio, which has, I mean, article after article in the mainstream media has pointed to the immense growth in that sector. So I think it's a missed opportunity if people aren't looking at that. And then the translation rights, because all of the other countries in the world are catching up still to the US and to the UK in ebook sales. And there's a lot of, I think, I don't know, you would know better than I probably if it's the iBookstore now that has some of the impressive growth internationally. I think Kobo too, in Canada and elsewhere, because it has the Japanese corporation behind it. So it's got that good international footprint. I think what most worries me, and one of the reasons Scratch was started, was to help authors be a little more aware of the long-term picture, financial picture for books and in terms of their contracts, because a lot of traditional publishers are really tightening up the terms and making it harder for authors to walk away. And I wish that the contracts were a little more this is probably hoping for the impossible, but a little more cognizant that the environment's rapidly changing and that, you know, that a contract that's set for a particular time limit, like 3 or 5 years, especially if it's ebook only, I think that's more fair and is better for everybody to be able to reevaluate whether that relationship or partnership should continue. But we're not anywhere close to that, I think.
Yeah, no, you're right. And it's so interesting to be kind of in this space and knowing what you're doing. And I get so frustrated when authors don't even read. There's a great book by Christine Catherine Rush.
Yes.
Contract Terms to Avoid or something like that. And it's very clear in there what you should not sign.
Yes. Every author needs, like, I feel like there's no excuse. You, like, need to know how to protect yourself. And then for other opportunities, going back to your original question, like there's so much happening that's interesting on the serialization side, not just with Wattpad, but just in general. So it would, I think we're going to see a huge growth in mobile reading. It just seems inevitable. So I think authors need to be keeping an eye on what services or platforms or opportunities are coming along to capitalize on mobile-based reading, because we haven't even scraped the surface of that. And Wattpad, I think that's 75% mobile-based reading. And that's, of course, a community of predominantly young people. So I'm just very curious to see how that evolves, because I think it's going to be one of the next great things for all types of authors, being able to deliver their work in a more appropriate way for mobile devices.
No, I totally agree with you. I mean, and just on the future of reading, I guess mobile is obviously one of the big things, but we've seen that scanning app, that fast reading app.
Yes.
Yeah, well, I can't remember what that's called, actually. But there's that. And then there's Google Glass, which is really interesting, because that kind of voice, you know, the heads-up display on things. You know, do you see this kind of technology changing the way we read?
I don't know. It's like, I feel like the one word at a time going really fast to increase your words per minute, that feels so goal-driven, like so, like you don't enjoy the reading as much. I may be very old-fashioned in thinking that, but it seems to me like, but on the other hand, when I tried that out, it kept me very focused. Like there was no way I could like go play Candy Crush while reading if I was in that app. But I think those feel very like far out to me as far as the immediate opportunity is. I'm thinking predominantly of app-based reading. In the US, I don't know if this is available in the UK yet, but Rooster is, I believe, just iPhone-based. It may be for the Android too, a way to read literature in serialized form. And then I feel like there's another one that I'm missing. Jukepop Serials, I can't remember if they're app-based, but there's some of these interesting offerings out there that some writers are either welcomed in, just no gates at all, you can give it a try, or you have to kind of get through some kind of submissions process. So I, at least speaking from personal experience, when I've read fiction or nonfiction on my phone, it's usually through an app. So I think... that's why I'm really focused on what apps are being developed that are going to be helpful in that way.
Yeah, absolutely. I read a lot on my iPhone, on the Kindle app. It's, you know, you think you never will, and then you start, and then it doesn't make any difference.
Right.
It's kind of crazy. But anyway, tell us a bit more about Scratch Magazine and what people can find there.
Yeah, so it's a quarterly publication, and we've had 3 full issues. One's totally free. If you go back to our fall 2013 issue, you can kind of get the whole experience and get an idea of what it's about. And then we have a January and an April issue out this year. So we always have a feature interview with a big name writer. So Cheryl Strayed, as you mentioned, is in the most recent issue. And then I usually do an industry themed interview with someone you may not have heard of, but has a lot of prominence somewhere in publishing. And then we do a couple personal essays each issue from people talking about the intersection of writing, money, and life. Mm. We do a round table that has a theme. So we've done web editors, creative writing professors, and what was the other
agents.
One? Oh, literary agents.
Yeah, that was a great one, yeah.
And then we usually fill it out with some kind of hard-nosed business stuff. So I always do a contracts piece. Mm. We had the P&L piece in the recent issue. I like to try and explore one trend really in depth and talk to a lot of different people about it. So last issue, I focused on cereals, which is why I'm kind of gung-ho on that after exploring that field. Mm. So, yeah, we try to have a balance of what I would call the life side, how these issues can be very personal, and how we develop attitudes to writing and money, and then also things that are very practical and try to advance people's understanding of the economics.
Mm. No, and it's fantastic. And I urge anyone who's interested in business, the business side of being an author, to check it out. Even if you don't want to be a full-time author, it's really brilliant for learning new stuff. I really enjoy it. And I read it on the app as well.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. So yeah, delivered by app or website, or if you want, we have a PDF and EPUB edition for people who prefer that.
Yeah. And just tell people how much it is.
Oh, it's $20 per year. A bargain.
It is. It's ridiculous. It's crazy for the amount of work you guys do. It's amazing. So thank you for all the work you do. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
And everything you put out. I mean, it's great. Your blog and, you know, you really do offer, I think, a lot to authors, which is just fantastic.
Thank you. As do you. To speak about consistency, which we touched on before, I mean, you've been consistently producing these interviews in multiple formats for several years now, I think.
Yeah, and four years. It's crazy.
Yes, yes. And, like, I'm sure you would say that has had immense benefit, even though you're giving away the content for free, at least this form of the content.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, I mean, we didn't even have time to touch on platform, but I know you have also been doing it for years. So, you know, I think when you're a writer like we are, it is easy in a way to want to do this as well. So, you know, it's a good time. So tell people your website and where they can find Scratch Mag online.
Yeah, I'm at janefriedman.com, and you can find my blog there as well, like as my huge archive of writing advice. And I have a little parody on the future of publishing if anyone wants a good laugh. And then Scratch Magazine is at scratchmag.net. And we have a blog too if you go to community.scratchmag.net. So either way, you'll get there.
Brilliant. Thanks so much for your time, Jane. That was great.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes at thecreativepen.com/podcasts. You can also get your free Author 2.0 blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at The Creative Pen or find me on Facebook at The Creative Pen. See you next time.